when Bobby Joe said that she might not make it through, I thought, well, yeah, even if you were well rested, this is not an easy passage to get through. There's a whole lot that goes on. And I know I've said that a number of weeks, and I keep saying, and it's one of those things I think of a couple years ago, or quite a few years ago now, our family took a trip to Colorado. I don't know if you've ever driven to Colorado, and you drive across Nebraska, and we drove across Nebraska, and we got to the Colorado border. First time we'd ever done this. And the kids are like, look, there are the mountains. And then 2 hours later, look there. I mean, they're like, and it didn't seem like they were getting any closer. And it just kept coming, going and going. And that's kind of what sometimes the book of Revelation feels like. It's like, oh, I'm getting there. Or how can this get any harder? And it just keeps going. Or like climbing a hill where you think I'm almost to the top. And then you turn another switch back and you realize you've got so much further to go. And the book of Revelation can feel like that, where it's like, oh, how much more can we take? We're getting close to the end. Okay. We're getting close. And the end is the best part. It's amazing. But we're getting there. So we have been looking at the book of Revelation all summer long. This last book of the Bible. This book that is fascinating. It's confusing. It's baffling. But it's filled with an incredible message. So I want us to step back. And I think one of the things we want to do is look at the big picture to see what's going on in the scripture. Sometimes we can get lost in all the little details, all the little pictures. We've got beasts with seven heads and 10 horns, and we've got a woman and she's got purple and scarlet. And then we've got five kings who were and one who is and one who is not. And then we've got, 10 other kings. And you're like, well, there's just a lot to take in, isn't there? But if we step back and take a big picture, I think we can see what's going on, or at least to have a better idea. So as a reminder, I'm going to remind you kind of how I approach the book of Revelation. Or maybe you've never heard me preach on Revelation. This is your first time, or you've only been coming for a few weeks, and you say, okay, I've heard about the book of Revelation, or I've heard nothing about it. So what is the book of Revelation? And this is how Pastor Carl and a lot of other scholars approach what's going on here. So the opening chapter of the book of Revelation, the very beginning of it says, puts a man named John on an island. And it says he has a vision. And he describes this vision in three ways, and he says he's going to use it for three. First, he writes it down as a letter. He sends it out to seven historical churches, seven actual churches, but he uses the number seven to say this is for all the churches. He sends it as a letter, so it's written in the first century to a bunch of first century people. So that's the first thing we keep in our mind. John also describes it, if you want to go back, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4 of Revelation. He describes it as a prophecy. And a prophecy not in terms of here's the future, but a prophecy in terms of saying God has said something and God has a message for us today. And how do we take the way we're living today and follow what God is saying? In fact, the book of Revelation has a couple of commands. And one of those commands is whoever keeps the words of these prophecies. In other words, somehow whatever's going on with all these fantastical images of a woman riding on a beast, somehow there's something we're supposed to obey. Not puzzle out, not decode, not figure out, but something to obey. The third word that he uses to describe what's written down is the title of the book. It's a revelation, but the word, the Greek word, the word underneath it is an apocalypse. And now apocalypse, we often think of as like end of the world, but apocalypse is just an unveiling, a revealing. It's a way of saying, here's what's really going on. And it's done through images, through numbers, through symbols. And so John apocalypse, he reveals, he said, you see things here on earth with your physical eyes. I want you to use your spiritual eyes, and I want you to show God, and God's going to roll back and show you what's going on behind the scenes. And when he shows the behind the scenes, he does it through images and pictures. And so he takes in one point up in the throne and he sees Jesus, but he doesn't describe a man with a beard and a sash around his thing. He says, well, there's a lamb who looks as if it's slain and it has eyes and horns. He's like, well, that doesn't look at all like Jesus. No, it doesn't, because it's a symbol. He uses numbers oftentimes. And the phrase I've come to adapt from some scholars is like, they're symbols, not statistics. So you'll hear the number seven again and again and again in the book of Revelation. And seven represents completeness. 10 is another number of completeness. And 4 is the number of completeness of the earth. So we saw it even in this passage here where we heard about peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. 4 times, kind of like we would say, what, the 4 corners of the earth. And so there are all these things going on. And so this is what's going on. So quick, we're going to run through a quick summary of Revelation up to this point. What's going on in the letter up to this point? So he addresses each of the churches individually, these seven churches around Asia Minor, what we would call Turkey. He addresses them individually, but he also says this is a message for all the churches. And then he gives a vision of God's throne room. We see God on the throne in this lamb who looks as if who was slain on the throne. A picture that this is God is ruling over the world, and this is how God rules as a slain lamb. And this is important for these churches because they need to be reminded that it doesn't always feel like that. And that's part of one of the key messages of Revelation. Is the early church was going through all kinds of struggles. They were being persecuted. They were also being tempted to stray from their faith. They were being tempted to compromise. And they need to be reminded that God is in control. That even in the midst of all the chaos, all the troubles going on, God is on the throne. Something we need to be reminded of sometimes too. That maybe some of us, we turn on the television, we look at our phone, we read a news. Some of you still read a newspaper, right? Read a newspaper. And you look through those newspapers and it feels like the world's out of control. And what is revealed to John, what is apocalypse to John is God is on the throne. And it's the same thing he's saying to these first century churches as they're seeing their sisters and brothers in Christ being hauled off to Rome, being thrown in gladiator pits to be fed to wild animals, being turned into human torches. All these things are going on. Or they're seeing syncretism, this mixing of Christian faith with their old religions of the old gods. And they're saying, God is on the throne and we need to pay attention to that. So then, after this vision of God on the throne, there goes through a series of seven, three times seven judgments. So again, seven the number of completeness. And so we see a series of seals and then a series of trumpets and then a series of bowls representing God's judgment on the world, but also God's cleansing of the world, that God needs to eradicate evil in the world. Because, spoiler here, the end of the book of Revelation, if you don't want to know, just plug your ears for right now. At the end of the book of Revelation, we see God coming down to make his dwelling with his people. It's called a new Jerusalem, a new heaven and a new earth. And so for God to dwell in peace and unity with his people where there is no more sorrow, no more tears, no more crying, no more pain, God needs to do what? He needs to eradicate evil. And so a lot of the book of Revelation, like from chapter 6 through chapter 19, is saying God is going to clear out the world and make it so that we can live in that paradise that he is bringing. And so this is what's going on. The church is hearing these messages because they need to know what's going on. The other thing we've met so far up through chapter 17 are the enemies behind the scenes. Back in chapters 14 and 15, there's a dragon and then there's two beasts. And we see that behind the scene are these spiritual things at work. The dragon represents the Satan, the Satan, the opposer, the enemy who accuses us, who tries to trick us. And then these two beasts, one from the sea and one from the land, representing human kingdoms as well as false religion and propaganda, trying to get us to give our allegiance to something other than Jesus. Because again, this is a key message in Revelation is, will our allegiance be to Jesus or to something else? And the false beast is always saying, well, give me your allegiance, give me your pledge. And this is what's going to be a big theme here. So, and in today's passage, we're going to meet another enemy called Babylon. Now I tried, as I was reading through this and studying and thinking about it, I tried to think of an easy way to go through this passage. I didn't find one. Okay, there was, because it's just, there is just a lot in there. You're trying to find out, well, what is going on here? So what's going on? At the end of chapter 16, the seventh bowl, this series of cycles of kind of building, of seeing like this is God's cleansing of the world. It's getting closer and closer, this repetition, it's going on. And it feels like it's the end of the world. And at the end of chapter 16 and verse 19, it says, the great city split into three parts and the cities and the nations collapsed. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. Which seems a little strange because back in chapter 14, we're told that Babylon has fallen. But it's even stranger because up to this point, we're wondering, who and what does Babylon have to do with it? Because written in the first century to a bunch of Jewish Christians living in East Asia, Babylon didn't exist anymore. So why is John talking about Babylon? And interestingly, how does he describe Babylon? Babylon, is Babylon a city or a woman? Both, isn't it? Which gets, I mean, these kind of these images shift back and forth, don't they? It's a city, but it's also a woman. But remember, they're symbols. So Babylon comes off as, Babylon becomes a place to live. I mean, if we think about a city, when we describe a city, what do you do in a city? You live in a city, right? And if you think about different cities, if you've lived in other cities around the country or visited other cities around the world, does every city do things the same way? Do they have different cultures, different ideals? And you, even across the United States, you could go and you could live in different cities. And by cities, I mean, we could be talking about Muskegon or Whitehall. I mean, areas, they have different cultures. They have different values, different ideals. And so to live in a city, as the Bible puts it, is to adapt those ideals. When you live in a city, you become part of that. And so then he goes on, but it's a woman. But again, the woman, it's not a literal woman, but a symbol. Because later on, we'll get another woman, a bride dressed in white. And so women often in the Bible, and this is, the Bible isn't misogynistic. It's not saying bad things about women because there's also a bride describing the woman. But this is a common symbol or metaphor used in the Bible. So some of you may read your Bible frequently and you maybe read the book of Proverbs. And in the book of Proverbs, there are two women described. There's Lady Folly and Lady Wisdom. Two different ways of life. It's just a way of saying, which one are you going to give your affections to, so to speak? Are you going to give your affections to Lady Folly, which will lead to destruction? Or you give your affections to Lady Wisdom, which leads to life? Or in this case, are you going to give your affections to the harlot? I'm going to use the word harlot. It's just kind of a fun word because whatever you... Harlot. Or are we going to give our affections to the bride, to the Lamb? And so they're to the bride of Christ. And so who is going on? So all these things are going on in the midst of this story. And Babylon becomes important because, I mean, we get two whole chapters about it. And so why so much time on Babylon, which we haven't even met yet? And we have to remember, Babylon was written to whom? It was written to seven churches back in the first century. Why? Because it was a call to faithful discipleship. It was a call to, like, what does it look like to follow Jesus? To follow Jesus means faithfulness to God. And faithfulness to God means not giving up in the face of persecution. Faithfulness to God means not compromising your faith when there are pressures around you. And so we're invited to see this pressure in Babylon. And so again, coming back to this, why Babylon? You think John was just thinking like, Babylon, that's a cool name. I mean, I kind of like the sound of that. Where did he get this idea of using Babylon as a symbol? So if we were to take our Bible and we were to go all the way back nearly to the beginning of the Bible, let's go all the way to the beginning. God creates the world, right? And he creates human beings. And one of the first things that human beings do is what? Decide they're going to do things their own way. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And then there's a flood on the earth and the world starts over with, you know, after a man named Noah saved in the ark. And then the people are on the earth and God still has the same command to them. They're supposed to scatter across the earth and be his representatives. But the people get together and they say, well, we don't like that idea. We're going to stick together and we're going to build a tower to make our way up to God. So any Bible students out there, what's the name of that tower that they build? Babel. Does that sound like something else? Babylon. In fact, it's the same word in Hebrew. It's the Tower of Babel. It's this first representation, this first picture of what it looks like to try to get to God your own way. But that's not the last time we hear about Babylon. Later in the Old Testament, the stories before Jesus, what we see is what happens is that the people of God disobey. And so the kingdom of Babylon, a physical city kingdom, comes and takes the people off into exile. So Babylon becomes a symbol that the prophets, that the people of God use. And so Scott McKnight says this. He says, Babylon became for Jews and early Christians the most graphic image, metaphor, or trope for a city filled with arrogance, sin, injustice, oppression of God's people, and idolatry. In other words, they would just use Babylon, and to a Christian or Jew, and they're like, oh, I get what you're saying. You're talking about sin. You're talking about oppression. You're talking about idolatry. Kind of the same way today we have those sort of things. So if you describe somebody or something as a Nazi, you don't need to go into the details of all what you mean by that. Everybody already kind of conjures up an image. Or you refer to someone as a Hitler or as a Stalin. You're like, oh, I get exactly what you mean. Or it could be, I mean, that we do the same sort of thing in a positive way. You maybe describe someone, oh, she's like a Simone Biles, or he's like a Michael Phelps, or like a Michael Jordan, or a Taylor Swift, whatever it is. And like, oh, you've got a picture and there's this image and it becomes a trope, a simple symbol. And so Babylon simply became a symbol that says, if I refer to something as Babylon, I'm talking about a city I'm talking about a way of life opposed to God. I'm talking about a way of life that oppresses God's people. I'm talking about injustice. I'm talking about arrogance. I'm talking about sin. So then in chapter 17 of Revelation, when John says Babylon the Great, he's not talking about what we know as modern day Iraq. He's talking about a way of life, a way of living. Because in fact, John is probably talking at this point not about Babylon, the physical place. He's probably talking about a physical place called Rome, because that was the source of oppression for God's people then. But Babylon doesn't end there. So that's the picture of Babylon. And so we get this picture of what is Babylon like. And so we get, what does it say? The kings of the earth says commit adultery with her. How do you commit adultery with a city? Well, what's the point? It's a symbol of idolatry, of compromise. Because when someone commits adultery, what are they doing? They're giving up an exclusive relationship they're supposed to have and giving it up for someone else. And so the Bible uses that as a symbol, saying we're supposed to give our exclusive allegiance, our exclusive devotion, our exclusive relationship to God. And so when we commit idolatry, when we give it to something or someone else, it's adultery. And so it's a picture. It's a symbol of political and religious compromise. And they're intoxicated. They're unable to control themselves. It's kind of like you get going on it and you just can't give up. And so when I'm reading the Bible, sometimes like these bizarre comparisons come into mind for me. So I'm going to offer you a bizarre comparison. You say, where did it come from? So going back to 1940, Walt Disney made a movie called Pinocchio. And in Pinocchio, you're familiar with the little puppet, you know, and Geppetto, and he asks, the blue fairy comes down and brings the puppet to life. And Pinocchio's not the best little puppet boy in the world, is he? And so he goes off and he lies. But there's a point in the story where a man named Honest John comes along and convinces him there's this place called Pleasure Island, right? Where he can go and do whatever he wants. And he goes, and Pinocchio goes off to Pleasure Island, and he gets caught up, and he's drinking, he's playing pool. And it's funny, like, how playing pool was like this great symbol of like waywardness and idolatry. But he's there and he's doing it. And what happens there? He just gets caught up in it all, doesn't he? He gets seduced, if we want to use the language, by Pleasure Island. And John is using that same sort of language here of the seduction of something. It sounds like a good thing. And then you get caught up in it and you get stuck in it and it becomes a pattern. And so when it says here, with her, the kings of the earth committed adultery and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries, it's saying whatever Babylon was offering, they got caught up in it. Like, oh, that sounds good. But then they wanted more and more and more, and they got drunk. And when you get drunk, what's one of the major things that happens when you get drunk? You lose control. You're no longer in control. And so when John says they were intoxicated by Babylon, it's like Babylon offered something. And the kings of the earth, the people of the earth said, oh, that sounds pretty good. I like that. And they got caught up in it and wrapped up in it, and they got stuck in it. And so we see this seductive power. And again, see how why that language works? This language of a harlot and seduction and saying offering up something good, but then you get caught up in something. So we might want to ask then, what is the seductive power? What is it that Babylon offers? Well, notice how the woman is described. She's dressed in purple and scarlet, glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. What are we told about Babylon in that little statement? Money, right? There's wealth. Is wealth seductive? Do people sometimes do the wrong thing in the pursuit of wealth? Do we need money? Yeah, we've all got bills to pay. If you don't have bills to pay, see me, please. I'll give you some of mine. But the reality, we need money's the way we operate, but we can get caught up in, just a little bit more. And all of a sudden, maybe we compromise a little bit. All of a sudden we realize I've got this report I've got to file, but if I just change a couple numbers here, who's going to notice that little change? And it'll put a little more money in my pocket because I've got kids going to college. And so that's the seduction, the power of Babylon is saying, here's this wealth and it offers up wealth. Babylon says, oh, you can have wealth. But then what it's saying is, again, Christians sometimes compromise because we think, oh, a little bit of wealth and then you get caught up and then it's just a little bit more and then just a little bit more. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard about pastors or about workers in churches who embezzled from their churches. Maybe they stole from the offering plate. Maybe they were the person who was responsible for counting the money and they took the offering plate and every time they took the offering plate back there, they just slid a few dollars out of it. And probably the first time they said something to themselves like, well, this week was a really bad week and I've got to pay this doctor bill and stuff. And they did it the first time. And what happens after the first time? The second time gets a little bit easier. And the third time, just a little bit easier. And the fourth time, and then all of a sudden, they're in the news because they're being arrested for embezzling hundreds of thousands of dollars from the church. And so here's this seductive power. We're going to talk more next week when we get to chapter 18 because wealth is one of the major things. So Babylon seeks to entice, but in the story, was Babylon alone? Was the woman alone? No, what was she doing? She was riding on a beast. Now, the question for me as I read this is, when you're riding a beast, who's in control? I've only been on a horse, not that a horse is a beast, but I've been on a horse a few times, and I'm not entirely sure who's in control. But I think here, as we see it, we're going to find out she's riding on the beast, but the beast is in control. The beast is in control. And that becomes clear in verse 16, if you're listening. The beast and the 10 horns will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. So the prostitute thinks, oh, this is great. I'm riding on the harlot. Thinks, like, this is great. I'm riding on the beast. Well, the beast turns around and eats her. She wasn't in control, was she? So let's take a quick look at the beast. And then we're going to tie those two together and then kind of begin wrapping. So we meet the beast. It says it's a scarlet beast with 7 heads and 10 horns, which sounds a lot like the beast we met back in chapter 13. Chapter 13 describes the beast as 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on its horn, and each had a blasphemous name. So we see this, we've met this beast. It's imperial power, it's kingdom, it's empire, it's political power turned against God's people. And then we get all these strange things where it was kind of this stumbling. So verse 8, the beast which you saw once was, now is not, and yet will come up. And you hear that phrase a couple times, you think, well, what is that all about? What I think is going on is John is making a parody between the beast and between God. Because one of the frequent descriptions of God is what? The one who was, the one who is, and the one who is to come. And the beast is described as the one who was, now is not, and yet will come up, but then go where? To destruction. So we have God, the one who was, who is, and is to come, to rule and to reign, and the beast who was, who is not, and will come, but go to its destruction. And so it's contrasting because the beast, what is the beast? The beast is always trying to imitate God. The beast is saying, well, I'm just like God. And John's saying, no, you're not. You are not at all like God. You think you are. You pretend to be like God. You get people to think you're like God, but you're not. And the people are astonished at its power. And so as we're reading this, we're thinking back. And we're thinking of what this beast is like. And I'm not going to take you there, but now, if you want I would encourage you, if you want to do a little study more on this, read Daniel chapter 7. Daniel has this incredible vision of these beasts and these things and interprets it. But what Daniel helps us do is set up John. And in Daniel, he has a vision of beasts and visions. But he says the beasts, these things, are kings and empires and powers of the world. And so I think John is doing the same thing. He's saying they are the things. In fact, he says what? They're seven heads, which are seven hills, which are seven kings. So you say, which are they? Are they heads, the hills, or the kings? They're all of them. It's describing, it's saying, it's a symbol, right? It's going on and it's saying, this is what they are. And they wage war against God's people. And there's seven of them. Why? Because there were little seven. And there were people who came up with all these kind of schemes to say, well, maybe this was start. If we start with this Roman emperor, and we take these three and we skip this Roman emperor, then we'll get five who've already been. And then that makes Domitian the current emperor. And then we're looking for the fourth. No, it's a lot simpler than that. He's just saying seven because seven is the number of completeness. And five fall and one is yet to come. Okay. Because he's saying most of it's past, but there's still a little bit more to come. And that one's going to fall. So you realize the beast who once said now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to seven and is what? Going to his destruction. Keep that in head. Because that's one of the key themes here is however we understand these beasts, whatever we make them out to be, whether they're particular kingdoms or they're just symbols of particular kingdoms, they all end up in the same place. Destroyed. Destruction. And so that's what John is trying to get across in this message here. So we have these 10 horns who represent 10 other rulers. And so I think, was the early church, when they read this, did they think about Rome? I think they absolutely did. I think they read this and said, this is Rome. The image of the seven hills. Rome had a festival of the seven hills. So they thought Rome. But is it just about Rome? No, I don't think it's just about Rome. It's about empires and cities throughout history that oppose God. And so I think about what this picture is telling us. It's saying there's a complete influence of evil. There's seven. It's complete. But one little detail. How long do those kings reign for? Verse 12. The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour receive authority as kings with life. Now, do you think, again, symbol or statistic? Symbol. Do you think he's saying like, oh, there's going to be a king. He's going to be enthroned for an hour and then he's gone. 60 minutes, you're up, time's up. It's a symbol because if we read further in the book of Revelation, we're told that the saints of God, the people of God, guess how long they reign for? 1,000 years. Or in some places, forever and ever. So we have an hour and we have 1,000 years. This is what John does all the time. He compares things. There's the mark of the beast and there's the seal of the lamb. Reigning for a year, or reigning for an hour, or reigning for 1,000 years? Which would you choose? 1,000 years, right? But here's where we go back to, is if you are suffering under persecution, if you're enduring something, an hour can feel like a really long time. But it's saying it's a short time relative to the rest of it. Because the people in those churches that John was writing to, they were undergoing persecution. Like I said, they would sometimes be sold. They would be put into pits to fight against wild animals. They would like maybe be dressed in an animal skin and then be sent in to fight a lion or a bear. There's no chance. Or sometimes slaughtered in other ways. And so there are all these things going on. And so when you're going through that, it can seem like forever. But what John is saying here is only for an hour relative to 1,000 years. I mean, it may be a week, it may be 2 weeks, it may be 3 years, it may be a longer period of time. There are Christians who've spent decades in jail for their faith. There have been Christians who have been beaten repeatedly over and over again over periods of months and years because of their faith. But they hear the words of John and they say it's only an hour. Because God is coming back and he's going to rule for 1,000, and we are going to rule for 1,000 years. So we're kind of putting together. So we have these two pictures of evil. We have Babylon, the woman, and then we have the beast. We have the woman who's seducing with luxury and wealth, and we have the beast representing power and nation and empire and kings. And so what do I think John is seeing? He's he's saying this is what draws people to Babylon. So Richard Bauckham, scholar, says this way, says, the harlot rides on the beast because the prosperity of the city of Rome at the empire's expense and her corrupting influence over the empire rest on the power achieved and maintained by the imperial armies. Essentially what he's saying is, here's this picture of Rome, and what's going on is the people of Rome, if you're a Roman citizen, you enjoy prosperity, you enjoy wealth, you enjoy a good standard of living. But the reason you enjoy that good standard of living is because the legions of Rome are marching across all of the world, conquering, bringing back slaves, bringing back plunder, putting people into slavery, and taking the riches of other countries and bringing them back so you can enjoy feasts in Rome. And so what happens is, if you're a Roman citizen, you can turn your eye, you say, well, I don't know, doesn't matter to me. Rome can do what it can do because in the end, I have my wealth. In the end, I can go to my villa and I can enjoy wine and meats and breads. In the end, I can go in and I can enjoy the people who serve me. I don't care that my servants came from a foreign empire. I don't care that that woman working in my garden used to have a husband who was slaughtered by the legions of Rome, because I'm enjoying it here. And so what John is painting with this picture of the harlot on the beast is how those two things go together, how wealth and imperial power and kingdom power often go together. And we sometimes get caught up in the same thing, that empire is tyranny and exploitation, but we don't resist it because we benefit. We accept and welcome the rule. You know, we'll put up with a little bit of authoritarianism in the Roman government because, you know what? Look at this nice house I have. Look at all these good things that are going on. And so we have these things that are happening where the harlot lives at the client's expense but offers them something. So Rome offers the gift of peace. Say you have the gift of peace, the Pax Romana. Well, the Pax Romana exists only because the legions go forth and they conquer and they crush. They fear. Do you know how they kept the peace, what the peace of Rome looked like? It looked like when the slaves rebelled, they took 6,000 crosses and strung them out the road and crucified 6,000 people along the road and said, this is the peace of Rome. Rome is providing peace as long as you listen and do what we ask you to do. And that's the seduction of the beast. That's the seduction of the harlot. Is we begin to compromise and say, well, I guess I can put up with that a little bit because life's good for me. And what Revelation does is portray this as a deceitful illusion, that we get caught up in all these things and we say, oh, if only I could. But what John is saying is we have to resist it because we have to disassociate ourselves, because it's so easy to get caught up in this. It's so easy to get caught up and begin to compromise. And that's one of the primary messages of Revelation, is to not compromise, not to begin to say, well, it's okay a little bit because I benefit. Instead, as followers of Christ, we're called not to look to our own needs, but instead to the needs of others. So the Christians would be thinking, well, wait a minute. I may be benefiting at this point, but my neighbors over there, they're suffering because of what Rome is doing. They're suffering because of what Babylon is doing. So I need to think that through. But in the end, it offers two messages for us. It's a challenge, and that's the challenge to come out of her in chapter 18, verse 4. It's for us to examine our own lives and say, where am I living in Babylon? Where have I been seduced by Babylon? Where have I given up what Jesus Christ has called me to do? Where am I looking a little less like the lamb and a little more like the beast? Is it in the pursuit of wealth, or is it in the pursuit of power? The attempt to impose upon other people, the attempt the looking like Rome, or is it looking like Babylon? Which one of those it is? And so the call here is, the challenge is to say, to come out of her, to not do that. But the other message that John is giving to us, to the early readers and then to us, is that the beast seems all powerful. And it's this strange thing going on in the book of Revelation, because if you read the book of Revelation, on the one hand, you're reading it, and it just sounds like the beast and his followers, they just get beat over and over and over again, don't they? I mean, you come to the end of the chapter, and it's like, oh, they will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them. I mean, it's not like, oh, it's going to be a hard battle, because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. There's not a giant battle. There's not, it's like, oh, Jesus shows up, battle done. But if you're living here on earth, because that's the unveiling, that's the reveal, that's the behind the scenes. But if you're living here, if you're living in Rome, if you're living in the United States, if you're living in China, if you're living in Sudan, if you're living in Syria, if you're living in Iraq, that's not what it feels like. Because you feel the oppression, you feel the persecution. If you're in jail, if your family has been taken away, it doesn't feel like it. And so what John is helping us to see, what God is showing through this vision, is that the Messiah lives, that he was, is, and shall come. And what we're seeing is, whatever is happening here, that the beast is not going to last, that he is defeated by the Lamb. In fact, the beast, I already told you, what happens with the harlot and the beast? Evil is such that it destroys itself. God allows it. God says, okay, fine, have your way, but the beast is going to consume the harlot. But Christians are reminded that in the end, and this is the where I want to close with, is to remember that in the end, no matter what's going on, we sang the song, what? The Lamb has overcome. That they would, the Lamb, and it says it multiple times here, says he's come out of the abyss and go to its destruction. Again, in verse 7, he belongs to the seven and he is going to his destruction. What is happening to the beast? What is happening to the harlot? What is happening to the Babylon? What is their final destination? Are they going to be sitting and reigning and ruling over us? No, they're going to their destruction. I want to close by reading a section from a commentary by Alan Bosack. Alan is a South African and writes from that perspective about the book of Revelation. And he uses the phrase, goes to perdition. He uses, instead of destruction, he uses the word perdition. So as you hear that, you can fill in destruction. And so this is what he says. And it's a fairly long. He says this. He says, and the suffering church of Jesus the Messiah in South Africa understands. The political observers count tanks and missiles, soldiers and guns. They analyze the strength of Pretoria, that's the capital, and count the threats and the dead bodies on the streets, and they smile paternalistically at the witness of the church. They ask for the reasons of our optimism. They do not understand the faith of the church. Neither do they understand the continuity of the biblical tradition. When they see guns and more guns, they see power. The church sees a growing powerlessness. It goes to perdition. They scrutinize a new law that gives even more frightening powers to the minister of law and order and to his security forces. They see power. The church knows it goes to its perdition. They look at the long list of names of detainees, lists smuggled out of the country contrary to the laws of the state of emergency, and they see power. The church prays for these people, calls their names before the throne of God, and knows that it goes to perdition, this beast. For the key here is not who the beast is. The church knows that. Neither is the key whether we begin counting and where we count from. The key here is the understanding of the mystery. This beast, this powerful, merciless, violent beast, was and is not and goes to perdition. The beast that you saw was and is not and is to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to perdition. It has no life and no future. It goes from hell to hell. And so we are reminded, people, that the beast goes to perdition, and that the Lamb has overcome. Amen.